As school germs return, rest easy. Clorox has got your back to school.
Ugh, you're back?
It is I, your kid's germy desk, and I've got things to say. I've been sneezed on, used as a tissue, there's chewed up gum under my...
Calm down. I'll get my Clorox disinfecting wipes.
Oh, and can you please get these sweaty gym clothes off of me?
School, am I right?
Clorox disinfecting wipes kill 99.9% of viruses and bacteria and clean hundreds of messes on hard, non-porous surfaces when used as directed.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 123 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. We are rapidly approaching the end of this season. We just have a few more episodes left, and we are also approaching our move to Spain. Erica and I leave in less than 3 weeks. So I'm doing my best to get all of these episodes prepared before we go and get this house packed up and get out of here. Today's episode is another from Bend, Oregon, another recorded on that road trip I took earlier this year. I am speaking with Marilee Valkes, and she is one of those humble people with so many life experiences, a human onion who you can just peel layers off forever and always find something new and interesting to discover. She is or has been a cyclist, a racer, an event organizer, an outdoor educator, a guide, part of the Altadena Mountain Rescue Team, a ski bum, a backpacker, an entrepreneur, one of the hosts of Chickaboom. If you don't know Chickaboom, look at past episodes of this show. They were two video series we put together for women, by women, featuring discussions that affect women in the outdoors. This is one of those episodes where we talked for quite a while on mic and then so much more even off the mic before we were on mic. There's so much to know about Marilee. You can learn a lot from her. So why don't you come with me to a beautiful little river in Bend, Oregon, a few months past, so you can hear Marilee talk about cycling, racing, guiding, ski bumming, her many business pursuits, what it's like to be an outdoor educator, and the joys of riding in a mini pirate ship.
My name is Marilee Valkes. I am a lover of nature. I moved to Bend in 2020 from Southern California, where I was born and raised.
And for people who don't know, you're going through a midlife crisis right now because I forced you to tell us about yourself, and then you really reflected on what you've done with your life.
What have I done with my life?
Well, the good news is we can spend the next hour and a half reflecting on that together.
Good. Let's come up with something good.
All right, so let's talk about your life, because when I initially met you, it's been a few years now, it was through Cindy, correct? When she was putting together the Chickaboom show, and you were one of the guests coming on, and so it was going to be a show for women, by women, talking about important things that affect women outside. That's how we initially met. Now we get to have an episode that's about you instead of about other people. So where we'll start is, you said you were born and raised in Southern California?
That's correct.
All right. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in the South Bay area, in mainly the city of Redondo Beach is where I grew up. But I grew up at the beach, which was actually a kind of a nice little town then. It was not quite the concrete jungle that it is today. I spent a lot of time, of course, at the beach growing up there, but my dad was a lover of the outdoors, and so most weekends we would pack up our van and we would go camping in the mountains or out to the desert. That's kind of where I fell in love with the great outdoors. And, you know, as much as I appreciate the beach, I want to be here in the mountains and the desert. And Bend, of course, is this perfect place where we have the Cascades. You know, we're kind of right between the Cascades, and I have the desert, and I can, you know, be in either place in, you know, 10, 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you just said you grew up, you know, at the beach, that was a surprise to me because I think of you as a mountain woman. I wouldn't have pictured you as a beach person at all. Clearly you were there at the beach growing up. Were you a surfer girl? Were you doing any of that stuff?
I did it all.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, really?
So, yeah, you know, in high school, I was, you know, I would go boogie boarding at the beach, and we would roller skate, ride our Strand cruisers. You had to have a Schwinn Strand cruiser back then when I grew up. And, you know, that was kind of my main mode of transportation. I was a member of an outrigger canoe club. In high school, I would go to school first thing in the morning, have gymnastics practice, and then go to school, practice after school, gymnastics, get on my bike after that, ride down to the harbor, and then paddle in the outrigger canoe for a couple hours, and then go home and fall on my face and fall asleep. But that was kind of my general lifestyle. I took up surfing a little bit later when I was an adult. And I was working for the Chart House in Redondo, and that's just what you did. You know, we would meet for what we used to call board meetings in the water, and we would surf. Yeah, right. And we would surf together, and then we'd come in, shower, and then go to work, waiting tables, and it was a great life.
So you're all waiting tables, but you're also all surf kids.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Yeah.
So that is probably the most Los Angeles beach community thing you could say.
I think so. Totally. Totally.
So at some point you get brought out into the mountains by your father, you said primarily, right? And
yeah,
he'd bring you out to the desert. So what was it about those environments that attracted you more so than those beach environments, you know, right near where you live?
I think, you know, part of the challenge of the beach areas is that they're highly developed. And so it's just part of the concrete jungle. Concrete goes all the way up to the Strand, and then you have the beach, and you're kind of, you know, you're kind of stuck. You've got ocean and then concrete, and you don't have the same spaciousness, I think. But also, I think that for me, I just remember being a little kid, and I'm like, Dad, I want to go to the forest. Let's go to the forest. And I, you know, I wasn't a big fan of the desert when I was a kid, little kid, because I'm like, it's the desert. It's hot. It's dusty. It's dry. And going to the forest. And one of the places that I loved was Chimney Peak. And I think we went there when I was probably 3 or 4 years old. And I always wanted to go back to Chimney Peak. And it just beautiful trees, the stream. And I'll just, that was probably my earliest impression of being in the outdoors, especially in the mountains.
And so when your father was taking you out to do these sorts of things, were they primarily camping trips, hiking trips, backpacking trips? What sort of things was he having you all do?
When we were young, it was mainly camping. And then we'd do some short hikes and some explorations. He put me in some little kids' work shoes, work boots, and little kids' backpacks, probably when I was more like 7 or 8. And then we started doing some short backpacking trips. And I remember that was really hard.
Do you remember what your introductory trip was?
You know what? I think it was somewhere up in the Mount Baldy area.
Oh, really?
Mount Baldy or Baden Powell.
Was it one of the Baldy trails or just in that vicinity?
You know, I think we went up, my memory's coming back a little bit. I think it was up near, Islip Saddle. I think it was in that area. So it was kind of like the a little bit west of Baldy and Baden Powell.
And you're about 7 or 8 at this time,
yeah,
you said? So did he make you carry all your own stuff, or did he give you a really cush, lightweight pack?
Well, I had to carry some stuff, but I'm sure he carried the food and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, yeah.
What was your reaction to it? Was it, oh, this is really fun, I want to do this some more, or, oh, I really liked it better when we just did these little day hikes with all this crap on our back?
It sucked going uphill. I hated it. I hated that. I hated the uphill part, right? Because, you know, it's hot, it's dusty, and my dad was, you know, He was a tough guy, and you know, but he was also, you know, understanding, you know, but he's like, come on, you can just put one foot in front of the other. He would tell us, there's an ice cream stand up at the top. So you just keep going, we'll get some ice cream. Yeah, he lied to me. Yeah. And we'd get up there like, damn it, there's no ice cream.
Well, I guess if he would have brought you up to the notch, then that might have been true.
That's true.
Yeah, because
but we were nowhere near the notch.
Right.
I didn't know about any notch with ice cream and beer.
So, but this didn't turn you away from it, even though it was really difficult.
You know, because in the end, like once we would get to camp, you know, we got to set up the tent, and then some trips we wake up and, you know, we got snowed on and, you know, we were in a tent and come out, oh my God, it snowed, yay. Yeah, and then of course there was always stuff, you know, I'd playing with sticks and rocks and, you know. It was, you know, and then there was, you know, Dad always brought something good to eat too, so that was kind of fun. You know, and having a campfire, that kind of thing. But yeah, I, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, as I got older and became a teenager, I kind of strayed away from that. That's kind of when I got more into the beach culture and started doing less stuff with my dad because, you know, it's just not cool to hang out with your parents right. when you're in high school.
You're going through that phase where you're thinking, well, I've got to figure out who I, or you're not even thinking this, you're just instinctually trying to figure out who you are, which often means having to break away from your parents.
Yeah. And I think it's just, you know, it's just what your friends have going on. It sounds way more fun. And the FOMO factor is huge when you're in school. My God, there's going to be a party. I can't not go because
right.
I'll be the one person in the crowd that didn't go.
And the socializing is more important at that point
yeah.
than exploring things.
Yeah.
Were the parties good? Were parties down on the beach good?
Oh, yeah. Some of them were good. Some of them were not so good, but most of them were good. You always went home with a little sand in your pants.
All right. So you grow up at the beach, but you actually return to the beach when you're a little older because you want to socialize more than explore the wilderness with your dad. You come home with sand in your pants frequently. And then at some point, you're going to become a waiter and also get introduced to actual surfing. And then, you know, you're growing up, so you are separating yourself from your parents and you're kind of finding your own path. So what did that look like? Because you have not been one of those people that was like, oh yeah, I went camping with my dad and that's in my past and I've moved on from that. I feel like you are a person who has taken that as an acorn and then grown a huge oak of yeah. your life out of that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the next, you know, phase into my got to get back to the mountains was actually a year out of high school. I graduated and I went to a year of community college and I was just so burnt out and I had a friend, she and I would go to Mammoth with her family through high school and ski all the time. So we just decided, hey, let's go move to Mammoth and work for the ski area for a season. And so we did. It was an incredible experience. First time out on my own. You know, we got a nice condo, rented a condo, and got a job and had to pay rent and actually on our own, you know, making mistakes and having a heck of a lot of fun. Yeah, just kind of learning to be an adult in a playground, really.
I think most of us learn to be an adult in a far less interesting place than a ski slope. So to get that job, was it competitive or was it very easy to get those jobs?
It was so easy. I couldn't, I was shocked. And I don't know why, because I just assumed, well, everybody wants to go and work up there. And, you know, but the reality is it's not practical for everybody. And in some ways, it's kind of a radical thing when I have, you know, I'm graduated from high school, a year of community college behind me. Everyone else is going off to university and starting their serious adult lives. And here we are. Hey, let's go work in a ski town. And we got hired very easily. Then it was like, okay, shoot, I guess we're going.
And were you working at the resort specifically?
Yeah. So I worked at the resort selling tickets, lift tickets, and which was a great job to have because on those stormy days, you know, if you're a lift operator, you're out there, it's blowing and snowing and you're digging out lifts and things like that. But, you know, for us, it was nice and warm in the hut. You go get your coffee and then you're in this little, you know, ticket booth and you're just selling tickets and it's, you know, the easiest thing in the world. And we got to ski for free.
Yeah, I was going to say, there must be perks.
Totally,
So your lift tickets were free.
Yep, discounts at the, you know, half price food, discounts at the the ski shop. And you just got to know everybody there.
And did you do this just for the season or did you end up staying at Mammoth?
Well, that was the plan.
While?
That was the plan. So my friend who moved up with me, she wound up leaving. She actually left before the season was up. She had a boyfriend down south, and she just kind of decided, nah, I think I want to go back. And so I had met some new friends, so I found a new roommate to come into the condo, and I stayed for the full season. The end of the season, you know, spring comes, summer comes, and it's just stunning. It is so beautiful.
There's so much more to Mammoth than just the snow season.
My gosh,
I mean,
yeah.
You're right there in the Sierra Nevada
yeah.
in a really gorgeous section of it.
The hiking, the biking, it's just stunning just to be living there, to call that place my home was just the best thing in the world. And so I called my dad. I said, Dad, I'm going to stay for the summer. He's like, all right, but you know, you got to get back to school. I'm like, yeah. And end of summer came and I had to make that call. Dad decided I'm going to stay up for another season.
Also, the fall comes and you actually get fall colors in that region.
The aspens turning, you know, bright yellow, red, orange. Stunning, and the sound of the aspen leaves.
Did you tell your dad that you were getting a different type of education that was equally important, that it was important you be there for all four seasons?
Oh, yeah, he wouldn't have it. You know, I think he was just terrified. You know, I think he was terrified that I was going to become a ski bum for life. And I think if I was a parent, I would, you know, I would feel the same. I would be afraid as well. You know, he just was saying that, well, the longer you stay away, then the less likely you're going to return to school. And
which is a very valid point.
It's true. But, you know, as it would come to be, you know, I stayed there for 3 years. I had the time of my life. I explored every part of that Sierra Nevada area. And I had so much fun. I partied like crazy. I crashed my boss's truck. What else did I do? I tried cocaine. And I had a bunch of different jobs. So mm-hmm. I got a lot of work experience. I worked, like I said, for the mountain. Then when the mountain would close, they'd lay us off. And then I'd go to work, you know, it was Safeway at the time. I think it's now at Vons. So I got a job there. And that was a pretty good job. Union gig, you know, you got insurance and you had all that. And I would, you know, I'd clean windows. And that's where my career with the chart house started, was at the Mammoth Chart House. And that's kind of the thing that you do when you live in a ski town. You know, you make okay money at the ski area, but in the end you still have to supplement it. And so the chart house was a perfect place because it was very lucrative. It was the place to be. Yeah, and I mean, shoot, I was, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know, working there, and it was just, I felt like I was on top of the world.
But at some point this comes to an end.
Yes. Well, you know, this little brain up here got bored. I mean, I loved being in Mammoth, that I didn't want to leave Mammoth, but how long am I going to wait tables for work? And how long am I going to take these odd jobs? And I always knew that I did want to get an, you know, advanced education. So it wound up that I decided it was time to go, packed up my car, bawled all the way down south, just cried and cried. And I just kept telling myself, you can always go back. You can always go back, do this for yourself, get your life established, and you can always come back. And so I went to North County, San Diego. I had a boyfriend who was also doing the same thing, and he was from that area. So I thought, okay, I'll go down there and I'll enroll back in, you know, community college. And so transferred to the chart house in Oceanside and got a job at a Pier 1 Imports. And I enrolled in some college classes, and I did that for a little while and broke up with the boyfriend. And, you know, ultimately wound up back in the Redondo Beach area, you know, went back to my dad's and went to El Camino College, finished a few classes, and then enrolled at Loyola Marymount, which is where I got my my bachelor's in philosophy and English.
Interesting. So you put off this education for 3 years, and then it's a philosophy and English degree, which are two things that are a bit notorious for not being the most useful when seeking employment.
What are you going to do with that, Marilee? Become a teacher? No, I don't know. Shut up.
So who was your favorite great philosopher?
Oh, gosh. I think Nietzsche was, of course, one of my favorites. But Kierkegaard, I liked a lot. You know what I just loved about it? All of it. It was just that it just taught me so many different ways of looking at life. And that was a really very useful thing. And I think, you know, people always say, so what can you do with philosophy? You know, you can't get a job as a philosopher, you know. But, you know, in the end, it was, I would always tell people, and it was a great interview question was, you know, well, how does philosophy help you to do this job? Or how does English and philosophy help you? And in the end, I said, like, you know, I can think and I can write. And it's funny because I wound up going into marketing with all that. And, you know, which is...
That's a field that does use both of those things.
Oddly enough, yes.
Philosophy to the extent that you can manipulate other people.
Exactly, right? Yep, that's right. And you know what? In the end, you can justify anything.
That's right. That's right. If you find the correct philosopher...
That's right.
To justify your experience.
Yes. Who am I channeling today? Yeah. No, it was very interesting, though. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's... but I will say that the marketing that I went into was sports marketing. You know, it was for a company called GT Bicycles. And, of course, I was into racing mountain bikes at the time, loved mountain biking, you know, so it made perfect sense to me. I'm like, I'm promoting a healthy lifestyle for people.
That's right. See, you already justified it, right?
Yeah.
Here.
what's wrong with selling bikes?
So you said you were big into mountain biking at that time. At this point, you're back in Redondo Beach?
Yeah.
So where are you going to do your mountain biking?
Yeah. So my first taste of mountain biking was in Mammoth. And I, you know, we didn't literally just on some bikes that weren't even mine. And this is fun riding in the dirt. And as a kid, I had grown up riding, you know, bikes on construction sites and, you know, and things like that, you know. And I'm like, dirt biking is kind of fun. I started mountain biking in Palos Verdes. And so Palos Verdes is just a little bit south of Redondo. And, you know, you have to drive up the hill to do it. But there were these dirt trails that went along the cliffs. And it was just the coolest thing to be able to ride your bike along the cliffs and have these beautiful views. And I don't know, it was just, you know, a lot of fun. And so that was my next kind of introduction to it. But the other thing is I had met a guy that became my first husband, and he was a mountain biker. So he kind of got me into the racing scene and introduced me to a lot of people. That was when I was in South Orange County. There was a place called El Moro, and they did these Tuesday night rides, and they had the fast group, they had the medium group, and then they had the slow group. So there was a ride for everybody. So new people could just hop on with the slow group, and you just had this camaraderie around you and people just welcoming in, you know, you in and like, come on, we'll wait for you, don't worry. And I remember, you know, there was the start of the ride was up this big hill, and I'm just watching these people pedal up this steep hill like it's nothing. And I'm like, you know, like cranking on my pedal, and finally I get off and I just have to walk up this thing.
Yeah, that's what I always have to do.
I'm like, you people, you're freaks, you know. Like, how does this happen? I fell in love with it, and I just kept every time I'd go up that hill, I'd ride a little bit further and a little further, and I started riding with people that were better than I was, and you know, and then I just got into it, and point where I'm okay, I'm gonna start racing. And you start beginner races, and you know, they're shorter, but once you do your first beginner race, you're like, oh, I can do this, I survived. Yeah, I just got hooked on it.
Yeah, and what was the draw about the racing specifically?
You know,
do you consider yourself like a competitive person, or was it something else?
I didn't think I was competitive. I just thought, you know, I thought this is actually, it looks fun. My friends are doing it. They're super fit. Yeah, I just thought I'd try it. And I was terrified. I was terrified the first race. But I just did it. I'm like, okay, just ride your bike. Just ride your bike. There's nothing at stake, you know. And I did it. And once you get past the starting line, you're like, oh, okay, I'm just riding my bike. And I loved it. And it's just kind of like, okay, I did that. I bet I can do it better next time. And then I started getting pretty good. I started winning races, and I went up to expert class. It was, I think at that time it was beginner, sport, and then expert.
Yeah, mountain biking racing, because mountain biking itself can already be pretty dangerous. You're moving at high speeds, downhill, jumping things, making sharp turns, you know, where there are high consequences. But then when you add racing into the mix, you're trying to do it faster than other people.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Kind of opens the door for the likelihood of injury to be higher.
Definitely.
So how many bikes did you break and how many bones did you break?
None.
Oh, you know, neither bikes nor bones.
Nope. And really the only thing that, you know, really ever happened was, you know, just the occasional flat. And I remember that when I was a beginner, I got a flat tire. I'm like, oh my God, how do I had a flat tire once. I fixed it once. How do I do this? And I couldn't remember. And it's always the rear. It's always the rear tire,
oh,
right?
Yeah, I know. And the rear is a pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah. You got to take the wheel off and you got the chain. And it's just, you're like, oh my God. And you're just, you know, freaking out. And breathe, Marilee. You can do this. Anyway, but that was probably the worst thing. I crashed, sure. I think, you know, the quote dangerous thing that I experienced, I'm on this super loose, steep downhill dirt trail. And it's a hot day. It's at like up at Snow Summit or one of those places. And I have my jerseys unzipped and I got my jog bra underneath it. Coming down, it's like super technical. Just hold on. All of a sudden, a big swarm of bees just comes and flies into my jersey. I'm like, oh shit. Oh shit. So I'm like pulling the zipper and I'm just trying to shake them out. And I think I only got like one or two stings and I didn't crash.
That is very funny because a few years ago, I was riding like some little easy mountain biking trail. And a bee flew into my face and stung my cheek.
Yeah.
like it accidentally smashed into me and
right.
then stung me in the face.
Well, you ran into him, really.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah,
his point of view.
I ran into that bee.
Yeah,
yes.
You assaulted him.
Yes,
so
I did.
That's
yeah.
why he's stung you. But
yeah.
now he's dead. So, yeah.
Yeah, so but, now
yeah.
I just feel even worse about
it.
But yeah, so who knew the most dangerous part of mountain biking was
yeah.
sudden
yeah.
bee encounters?
Totally, totally. And I raced cross country. I wasn't doing downhill.
Okay.
And so I really, you know, there's something I love, you know, I love climbing hills and climbing and descending, but I think cross country just kind of brings together the best of what mountain biking has to offer, you know, and it just feels so good when you're fit.
What kind of variety of courses were you on? Were you always racing in the same local vicinity or were you traveling and racing
in
different places?
So yeah, we travel. In the LA or Southern California area, we'd, you know, go up to Big Bear and there'd be, you know, hot mountain races. And then there were places like out at Castaic Lake, it's kind of a more of a deserty, dry, you know, atmosphere. But then when I was working for GT Bicycles, I was in charge of the big rig and the sponsor, you know, relations. And so I traveled around all over North America. I was able to race at all of those venues. So I was anywhere from Park City, Utah to Mount St. Anne in Quebec, Colorado. And so that was really exciting just to be able to race all those different courses, because my best finish was at a World Cup race that was in Vail, Colorado. And it was, you know, it, at that time it was really hard because I had to set up all the big rig. We had all this hospitality station. I had to make sure all the sponsors were happy and they had all their things that they needed. And then I'm like, Marilee, your race is starting in 5 minutes. Oh shoot. You know, put on my, you know, my spandex and grab my bike and go. And so it was always extremely stressful. But once I got on the bike and started the race, it was like, okay. Now I'm just riding my bike. But anyway, I finished 10th and that was in the expert class. I'm like, I think that's good enough, because I'm not going to go pro. You know, there's that kind of that point in your life where you're like, you know, you have to be able to train all day. No, I can't do that. I have a full-time job. I travel a lot and I want mountain biking to be fun and not training.
Right. There's that point where it could turn into your job in a sense,
yeah.
right? And then before you know it, maybe you realize you don't like it anymore because you've turned it into this huge responsibility.
Job. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So
yeah.
when you were traveling around doing all these different races, are there any standout courses or standout areas that come to mind?
Yeah, the Park City area, Deer Valley, we did some riding up there. And Mount St. Anne was really special, too. That was really beautiful. And a lot of the fun was actually all the events that they would have that were related to the mountain bike races. And, you know, the parties on boats and yachts and things, you know. There was one, actually, we had a race up at Big Bear. And we rented this tiny pirate ship.
Wait, when you say tiny pirate ship, is it a modern boat decorated to look like a pirate ship? Or is it sincerely like...
It was a little pirate ship.
So it was like a sailboat?
Yeah, it was. And it was funny because we did it as kind of a fun activity for our sponsors and the, you know, key people at GT Bicycles. It was this rinky-dink, chunky but rinky-dink pirate boat. And we just went out on Big Bear Lake and we're just, you know, sailing around drinking margaritas. And I mean, I'm surprised that it was seaworthy or lake-worthy.
Yeah, it might not be seaworthy. It may only
right.
be lake-worthy.
Yeah.
Did you feel obligated to pillage
other boats in the on the lake.
We were the only boats out there. There was nothing to pillage. Oh yeah, that was just so much fun. Yeah.
Maybe everyone looked out, saw the pirate ship, and they're like, "Oh shit, we better stay off of these waters."
Yeah, we know what they do. We know what they're up to. It was in the spring, I think, and so it was still pretty cold. So a lot of boats weren't out there at the time. But we froze our asses off on that boat. But yeah, and I think the boat had been used in a movie.
That sounds like a reason why it would exist.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know if they still have it or not, but anyway, that was really fun.
So the thing that comes to mind when you think about traveling from mountain biking to race is riding in a miniature pirate ship.
That was definitely one of the highlights for sure. But I think the other part of it is the personalities that I traveled with. Just the people that were on the circuit, the wrenches for the teams, all the support staff, they're just wild and crazy people having, experiences and, also butting heads with people, just because it's, you're on the road, you got a lot of pressure. You got, deadlines, you got sponsor expectations, you've got teams, you have your pro riders that are, have personalities that run the gamut from like super nice and easygoing to prima donnas.
Right,
and,
to do you know who I am?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So you said you were both working on these trips, but also competing.
Yeah.
So you were having to run both of those things simultaneously, but you reached the point where you came in 10th and you decided that was it for you. So did you just stop racing from that point or you just...
I did.
Yeah. So then what happens in life at that point?
Yeah. I just started riding for fun, but that wasn't easy because once you have been competitive, it's hard to not be competitive. And so...
Even if it's just with yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so my friends were and still are very strong riders. And so, there's always that little voice inside saying, oh, you can't let this person pass you, or you don't want to be the slow one. You don't want to be the slow person. It's kind of silly, if you really think about it, it's silly. Like you're either riding your bike to have a good time, or you're obsessing about, not being good enough or fast enough. And, I think you're kind of like, I would judge myself and I should be faster. But in the end, I wound up, my career started taking off. And when I left GT Bicycles, I went to work at a .com that I'm not riding nearly as much as I was. I would put in long hours and, because of that, that tech culture is just brutal. I loved the job. I wanted to put the time in because I wanted to, advance and learn as much as I could. But that comes at a cost. You're sitting at a desk all day and I only maybe ride on the weekends unless I'd get up maybe early in the morning and go before work. But yeah, and then I wound up co-founding a company after I left the GoTo was the company. And then that took even more of my time. So my activity level kind of plummeted, although I would ride my bike to work.
What was the company that you co-founded?
It was called Retention Education. We created interactive kind of workplace focused ESL programs for Spanish speakers that didn't have the ability or the time, to go take English classes. So we partnered with the Coca-Cola company and they sponsored our first curriculum development. And we partnered with Leapfrog, the interactive toy company, and used their platform. It was a touch and talk paper-based multimedia platform that you didn't need to have a computer to use. It was portable. You could take it, with you. And we created a curriculum that was to help Spanish speakers to improve their English in the workplace. And so we partnered with a bunch of Coca-Cola's customers, like their fountain customers, Del Taco and, all these big fast food and companies and hotels. And then we created this program that we basically sold to Coca-Cola's customers, and they would buy it and they would give it to their employees who could, at that time, they could take it home and use it on their own time. But then, of course, you have workplace, labor issues involving that. So then they would give them time to actually use the product at work. And it was a kind of thing where they could hear a voice say these words, and then they could record their own voice, play it back, and say, oh, I sound just like the model voice. So, my gosh, I can speak English. It's amazing. And it changed a lot of lives. It actually, people to see their faces light up when we would show them the product, because we did a lot of testing with them in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And literally, people would just break down in tears because, this is the product that's going to help change my life. going to help get me somewhere.
How did you end up in that? Because that's quite a difference to go from working in marketing for a bicycle company to, I have no idea what GoTo was.
GoTo was like Yelp is today.
Okay, so GoTo was like an early Yelp, which again, still to me doesn't say ESL.
Right.
So somewhere from bicycles to GoTo, you somehow end up in ESL, but not even just working in that field, co-founding a company.
Yeah.
So is there an interesting story there?
It actually is kind of interesting. So GoTo, you know, because being basically what Yelp is today, what is Yelp? It's a enhanced directory for, you know, people to find the things that they're looking for. And so at that time, back in the, you know, digital stone age, it was right at the kind of the cusp of when, you know, phones were coming out with internet. Mm-hmm. capability. And so we were selling enhanced listings to food companies, restaurants and you know, food service companies. And so we would take their data and you know, put it into our system so people could find out what their hours were and what their menu was and this and that, right? And all that was very new at the time. So we had this connection with the Coca-Cola company. They were one of our customers. And again, because they were also, you know, working with us to kind of bring their customers kind of an added value that maybe Pepsi didn't offer their customers because it was such a competitive business, still is. And so we had these connections. And when GoTo kind of tanked, you know, we all got laid off. And one of the VPs from GoTo contacted me and said, hey, I've got this small company. I'm working with this guy whose grandfather was the founder of Univision. So he said, we're doing some Hispanic marketing and, you know, I want to know if you want to come work with me. And so I went in and I worked with him, and we were working specifically on employee loyalty programs because the biggest challenge for the food service industry is employee turnover. It costs so much money because all the employees know that, look, if I quit here, I can get a job across the street. And maybe for a quarter more an hour. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's just nobody's really loyal, right?
Yeah,
so
it's a transitory job for a
lot
of people.
Totally, yeah. And it was especially high among the Hispanic employees because, you know, a lot of them, they don't have the language skills to communicate with the managers. Culturally, especially, you know, people from Mexico, culturally, they are not allowed to, you know, look the manager in the eye or look the boss in the eye and communicate with them. They're supposed to do what they're told, and you don't ask questions. You don't report any hazards. You just because that's not your place. You know, if they have to go home because of a health emergency or maybe, you know, somebody's ill at home and they need to take time out, they just quit. All right, now we have to hire somebody else and retrain them. And it cost, I can't remember what the amount of money, but it was in the tens of thousands, you know, of dollars per employee. So anyway, so that was the challenge. So we would put together these concerts. If employees who, you know, had great attendance or something, you know, you could win a chance to see Juan Gabriel, you know, who's coming to town. And we'd put together these, you know, these tours and phone card promotions. So we came up with these Hola Coca-Cola cards that would, that the employers would give out to their employees if they, you know, didn't have an accident for a month or something. I don't know. There were all kinds of incentives and things like that, or just employee appreciation, if nothing else. And so in the end, we discovered that the problem was communication. And so my partner in this company, Bill, brilliant guy, really just a really visionary person. We're kind of thinking, well, you know, how can we solve this problem? And we happened to meet this guy that had this great idea, this ESL program that involved these tapes, and it was really wonky and old-fashioned, and it had paper, and it was just, you know, how do you even manage a program like that among tens of thousands of people or more? And so in the end, we wound up getting connected to LeapFrog. Because Bill's daughter at the time, she had one of those little leap pads. Mm-hmm. And so we knew somebody that knew somebody at LeapFrog, and we had a meeting with them. And then before we knew it, we had a platform, and we got connected with some people that were kind of in the ESL business. And I became the director of curriculum development, and I hired linguists, I hired instructional designers, and all from different Spanish-speaking backgrounds.
At any point, did you turn to someone and say, hey, when you asked me what I was going to do with philosophy and English degree, will I be a teacher?
Here it is. I'll be the director of curriculum development.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah, who would have thunk it, for sure.
So what ultimately happens with that business?
So we were very successful in the beginning, and Coca-Cola funded our first curriculum. And after that, we brought in some angel investors, and then we wound up raising venture capital. We became very successful. I think our first year, we wound up $2 million. The next year, we developed more curriculum. We created a curriculum for construction. We partnered with the Home Builders Institute of America and Lowe's. And Lowe's became our sponsor. We kind of had the Lowe's logo on our books. And that was a really fun project because I got to work with the HBI, the Home Builders Institute people, and Lowe's, and a number of people from, you know, the construction industry. And, you know, safety is their number one concern. And we had a book that was totally about safety issues and, you know, encouraging people to report safety hazards and injuries and things like that. And so that was a fun one. Then we created a general market version that would apply to other industries, and we created an English to Spanish version because all of the managers were saying, we want to learn Spanish.
Right, because they can't communicate outside of English, right?
Yeah, and so we developed a mirrored curriculum so they could learn together, and that was really fun. But then 2008 happened. You know, we were getting ready to develop a civic literacy program, and then everything just tanked, and we lost funding.
Banks were going to fail. Housing crisis. Right.
Yeah.
And huge economic.
Exactly. And this is kind of a product that you sell to human resources. And that's all of the training and human resources gets cut first. But yeah. And then that was pretty much the end of it.
So you did that for a while. That was taking you away from a lot of your other pursuits.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was rewarding in a way to where you didn't have to convince yourself that it was okay for you to have that job. Like perhaps you had had to do in the past.
Right.
So where do you end up after this? Where does life take you once 2008 destroys everything?
Yeah. Simultaneously, when I was building that company, I was earning my MBA. So that also took away any time of recreating and, you know, but I finished my MBA at the time of the crash or just before the crash. And so
from philosophy and English mm-hmm. to business administration.
Yep. And, you know, it was a great program. Got to go to India and Thailand and China. There were two main takeaways from my MBA program. Loved it. But the first takeaway was I knew a heck of a lot more about business than I thought I did.
Just from helping operate one.
Just from my business experience, my practical experience.
An employee for years.
Exactly. The second takeaway was, not really into this business stuff. I think it's time to move on. And so I did. So from that, I wound up putting on cyclocross races with a friend of mine.
All right. So explain to people what cyclocross is if they're unfamiliar.
Yeah. So cyclocross is where a bunch of people in spandex and 10-speed bikes run around a course that's littered with obstacles, dirt, sand piles. Yeah. They just go in circles. It's a pretty, pretty demanding, you know, sport, but it's a lot of fun to watch because it's a closed course and it's a small course, and they feed donuts to people in the feed zones, and they really have a lot of fun. But a friend of mine, we used to race mountain bikes against each other, and she was putting on cyclocross races, and so I came on and I just started helping her doing that because I thought, okay, I'm just gonna stay out of the office. I'm tired of corporate America and
is this just
business.
For fun, or is this?
Yeah,
is
this was something
a job
that
also?
It was a job. It was a job. Yeah.
So and there were enough of these events.
Yeah, it was seasonal, and I was married with Greg at that time, and I'm still married now. Don't mean to indicate anything else, but anyway. but I didn't have to work, and I'd made some money and invested and saved, and so I didn't have to do anything right away and anything, you know, major in my career. And so I just thought, I'm going to take some time off and do this because I just love being outside, and that's kind of where I want to be. And so I started doing that, I did that for a few years, and just for the cyclocross season. And then off season, we would do things like go and help, like the Wounded Warrior Project. We'd go to the Nellis Air Force Base, and we would do timing for their Wounded Warrior races and things like that. So we would do kind of, you know, off season projects with the timing system that we had, and help put on events like Seek Libya and, you know, things like that. So that was really a lot of fun, just kind of doing whatever came up and working with cities and helping them put on cycling events. And then I got into coaching women, teaching people how to go backpacking. That was just kind of a random thing that happened. One of my neighbors would see all my posts on Facebook from my backpacking trips with my girlfriends, and she's like, we have a group of moms, you know, we get together all the time and we want to go backpacking and we want you to teach us how. All right, well, yeah, sure. And so I put together this kind of little, like, you know, met with all the moms, and one night we just kind of talked about things. And so I said, okay, you know, just wanted to figure out what they wanted. And so I put together a kind of a little curriculum. Okay, we're going to, you know, get together all of the equipment that you're going to need, and then we're going to meet at a park and we're going to learn how to use it. And so everybody brought their tents, their stoves, their water filters, and all their gear. And we just laid it all out and, you know, just did a big kind of shakedown of, okay, you don't need this, you know, this you need. Yeah. And, you know, let's set up your tent now. You want to do it now before you go on the trip and things like that. And then we put together a backpacking trip up in the Mount Wilson area.
Oh, so it was not to Islip Saddle. You did not want to give them your experience.
You know, I knew that I couldn't take them up that big, steep, dusty, dry, backbreaking hill. That would not make them happy. Mm-hmm. We did a nice backpacking trip up in the Mount Wilson area, and it was shaded in the trees, and it was just a lot of fun. So that was kind of a thing I did for a while, and that was really fun. Different people would contact me, yeah, can you help us get, you know, and so that's kind of my, I guess, my re-intro and getting, you know, my life and my livelihood back into the forest.
How was it bringing new people up there? Because that can go any number of ways. It often can be super rewarding because you get to watch this progression, but also you sometimes might see someone break down or realize this is not for them. Or
yeah,
what sort of experiences did you have?
Yeah, you know what, I have to say I was really lucky. You know, I was very careful. I didn't just take them out cold. We'd go on a day hike first, for sure, and just go, okay, let's kind of see where everybody's at physically and mentally, you know, and then you just kind of have to pick the destination, you know, accordingly and say, okay, you know, you kind of want to find out who's the weakest link and just kind of, you know, assuage any concerns or, you know, limitations. Yeah, I think I was really good at that. And it was just, you know, we're all in this together. If somebody is really afraid and doesn't want to go and do this, we're not going to do that. We'll just do something else. And you just, I think the key was just getting everybody to agree on that, and which is, that's the secret to any, you know, planning any outing with any group is, okay, we have to kind of, let's set the ground rules and come to an understanding first before you go out and, you know, start fighting. I did have one instance where I took a group up Mount Whitney, and the group just, we couldn't make it to the top. We agreed on a turnaround time, and we had to get back. And, you know, one person wanted to stop and swim at the lake. And we had to get back. We had to, you know, we were on a very firm deadline. We knew that it was kind of a little bit treacherous going down. There was snow and there was, you know, loose rock. If we stop now, we're not going to have time to deal with any issues if somebody gets hurt or whatever. We want to, you know, be able to be back at camp before sunset. And so, you know, this person was really, really adamant. And she's like, well, just leave me. And,
she's,
you know,
like, I didn't come all the way here to not swim in the lake.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And we said, look, we just can't do it. We all agreed we had to turn around this time. And it was really interesting, that dynamic. And so in the end, you know, I got her to come back. It was not a very pretty incident.
It's funny, it's almost like dealing with summit fever, but in this case, yeah, it was lake swimming.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was something I didn't even see coming. You know, I thought we had talked, right, to, you know, did all the preparatory stuff, but, you know, but that's, we learn as we go, right?
So when you were going out, this was all women?
Mostly all women.
Mostly
but
the, women.
But I did have some mixed groups, yeah.
And was it often the same group of people, or would it be totally different groups?
It'd be
time?
different groups, yeah.
And did you notice any big changes? Like, did anyone come in
very unsure about what they were going to do and then be a totally different person at the end?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, the most gratifying piece is that, you know, you have somebody that will come in and they're afraid and, you know, very tentative and just because they don't believe in themselves and,
right.
and or they're just, they've been, you know, taught to be afraid of being outside. What about bears? What about, you know, cougars and, you know.
Cougar bears?
Cougar bears. Totally. And snakes and, you know, all these things. And so, you know, once you get somebody out there, they survive a night. They wake up. Oh my gosh, I'm here. It's pretty transformative and it's very empowering to so many people. And I find especially women, but I've also experienced the same with men that just, again, they grew up in the city or, you know, they never just had a chance to be outside or you don't go outside without a gun or something. You know?
Yeah.
It really is. I've literally had people break down in tears of joy and gratitude, you know, for me bringing them out and you know, showing them this experience and you know, giving them the chance to prove to themselves that they can do it.
Were you surprised how rewarding it was for you once you started doing it?
Yeah, I think it never occurred to me. Yeah, I mean, it's oddly enough, it never occurred to me that that it could be that meaningful for so many people. I think for me, being exposed to the outdoors and camping and being dirty and grubby and convening with nature, I think it just was kind of a given because that was my life as a, you know, from being a young child. And I think I didn't realize how transformative it could be.
Yeah, I think something too that happens because I'll notice, like, if I do any particular activity for a certain amount of time or a trail or a canyon or a climb or whatever repeatedly, I will start to get really bored with mm-hmm. it. But if I bring someone and introduce them to it, it's the same thing I think parents have all the
yeah.
time, right? Introducing children to things
yeah.
and then getting to relive the excitement of it. But then also it's this sense of accomplishment that you've now shared this thing and passed on this knowledge
yeah.
to someone else who maybe will do the same thing later.
Yeah.
Once again, what we were talking about earlier, where you're like, you felt like you had to justify why you do things.
Right.
Sometimes this becomes one of those ways that makes it justifiable is you share these things to other people that make
yeah.
your life have meaning and then hopefully add extra meaning to their life.
Yeah.
So why did you stop doing that?
Well, to be honest, I haven't really stopped. It's just different. I just don't market myself as an adventure coach like I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've worked for REI now for 6 years. Working for REI and having so many different colleagues with different, you know, levels of experience, we get a lot of people that don't have as much experience as, you know, I do. They haven't been backpacking. They hike, but they haven't been
right.
backpacking.
Yeah.
And I, with a couple of my colleagues, we take mostly women, again, out on these trips where they've never backpacked before. And so it just kind of happens. Or like I'll meet somebody in the store and I'm helping them. They're getting ready to go on a trip and they're, you know, they're terrified. And, you know, and so just helping to coach them just as an employee, helping to outfit them and to also give them tips and, you know, tell them where they can go to train and things like that. Sometimes I end up, you know, saying, well, you know, I'll take you out. Let's go out. And I just do it for free. I just, you know, connect with these women. And yeah, I feel like it's, you know, it fulfills me so much, you know, to introduce people to just reconnecting people with nature. I think it's what the world needs.
Yeah, it's something that comes up on this show all the time. And it's part of the impetus for me to want to do it is I think our society has pulled us away from it for many decades and centuries, and we've kind of forgotten our place in it, and we've learned instead to fear it and to, I don't want to say abuse it, that we do that, but you and I were just talking about it earlier. A lot of our concept as humans about nature is resource extraction. It's value to us as a resource, and that there can be greater value there, or just at least additional value
mm-hmm.
to it outside of resources.
I would add too that I think for so many people, nature is dangerous.
Right.
You can freeze to death. You can, you know, die from heat exposure. You can drown in the creek. You can get hurt. You
right.
can get injured. And so there's so much fear built around that. And a lot of that, of course, is it's all society driven. We live in a culture of extremes. Most of what people hear that has to do with nature has to do with, you know, oh, somebody died in an avalanche again, and somebody, you know, somebody died, right? And it's always the negative.
Right.
And
and this is the thing people always complain about, too. The news only shares the negative thing or the bad thing. Yeah. It's like, well, of course, because it's not a news story to say family went out hiking, had a great time, went home.
Totally.
You'd be reporting that 500 times a day.
Yep.
And that's not news. The news is something that's different out of the ordinary. So by nature that you're hearing it on the news means that it is not overly common.
Yeah.
Typically.
Yeah.
But you're talking about how people say, like, you could drown, you could freeze to death, and all those things are true, but it comes down to familiarity, right?
Yep.
Because in everyday society, there are tons of things that are dangerous, like driving cars, but we're familiar with them, so we do it all the time. Far more people are dying in cars than backpacking trips.
That is the truth.
So you're now at REI, you said, for 6 years.
Yeah.
And you're helping people get outfitted for their own activities. Over those 6 years, have you noticed any difference? Because I feel like REI has kind of grown and it's become more popular. It exists in more places. More people are familiar with it, which means there are probably more people coming who are even less familiar with the outdoors.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that change? And
yes.
Then what does that look like?
Definitely. And, you know, and I think that's what, you know, really makes me, I mean, one of the many reasons why I stay and why I work there, because I love to be able to help people that are kind of uncomfortable or afraid to ask the dumb question,
right,
or they don't know what to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so I've learned to, you know, to talk to people and find out, okay, where are you going? You know, what is it that you want to do? What are you worried about? It's just great to have those conversations, because a lot of these people, and a lot of them are women. But again, I get some men in the same boat.
It's probably just the women are more willing to admit that they're afraid of something than the men are.
Maybe. I think that is true to a little bit, to a certain extent, because, you know, a lot of men that I have encountered and, you know, I've actually had conversations with, it's not, you know, it's not manly to ask these questions. Or what are you scared? And, you know, but no, I mean, yeah, the women are definitely, you know, they are much more inquisitive. And but, you know, it's there's also things just like, you know, peeing and pooping in the woods and dealing with your period on backpacking trips. Are the bears going to come eat me because I'm bleeding? Like, no, they're not. It's okay. But, you know, having women, you know, on the sales floor at REI is a huge benefit, you know, to help, you know, other women. And again, and now we're getting more new people coming in, especially in Bend. We have so many people moving here from San Francisco, from Seattle, and they're city dwellers, and they want to start doing all the things. They want to start, you know, whether it's hiking, cross-country skiing, paddling on the river, and they know nothing about what they need. I just like being that friendly resource for them, where they can come and, like, look, I've helped you today, I've answered these questions, but call, ask for me if you have any other questions. Come back and see me, and, you know, and I will guide you, and, you know, and connect you with resources and things like that. And and that's just a really great, I mean, it's like the best job in the world.
So you've set up the segue for me already, mentioning Bend and being in Bend and people moving to Bend. So you grew up in Southern California. You lived in Central California, technically, for a little while in Mammoth. And then you returned to Southern California. And as far as I know, until you moved to Bend, you've always lived in Southern California, right?
That's correct.
So Bend is in Oregon, if anyone's unclear where we are. Why Bend? How did you end up moving here? Why did you move here? And what do you think about Bend?
Oh, well, I love Bend, first of all. I discovered Bend through a very good friend who was coming up here a lot. In fact, I had met her in Mammoth. We had been friends for years and years. And so she would come up here, and she had her eye on the place. She had lived in Mammoth way too long, and, you know, she was ready for something different. And of course, Bend is just the ultimate playground. So I'd meet her up here. We'd camp, we'd, you know, explore, we'd do all the things, ride our bikes, and she moved up here, finally, made the jump, and I would come up every year. I just fell in love with it, and I thought, okay, you know, my dream was to be able to live somewhere where I could, in the winter, get up in the morning, go and ski before work, especially Nordic ski, skate ski, classic ski, whatever, to be able to do that. That's something that you just cannot do that in Southern California. There's nowhere. You're lucky if Rim Nordic opens at all, you know, up in Big Bear, but then you have to drive 3 hours to get up there. You just can't do that. So that was always kind of something that was that I always dreamed of. And then I knew that I could ride my mountain bike, and I knew I could paddle. I could do all the things. I could kayak. I could do it all. Yeah. So then, you know, COVID came around. My husband was able to work remotely, which so many other people found themselves in that very same position and said, well, why are we hanging out here? And so we happened to be visiting my friend and happened to come across this amazing house that needed a little TLC and made an under market offer, and it was accepted. And all of a sudden we're like, oh, okay, I guess we're moving. Oh, what are we gonna do now? We have this other house, so what are we gonna do anyway? But yeah, it happened just like that.
So what does that look like for work? Because you were already working for REI in Burbank,
yeah.
Correct, right? And
yeah,
in Los Angeles.
Yep.
So did they happily transfer you to the Bend REI, or did something have to happen there to make that?
It was the easiest thing when I told them that we'd bought a house in Bend. My GM said, I will happily call that GM and, you know, in Bend and give you a recommendation. And that's what happened. And I touched base with them here. And you know, Bend at that time was very hard to get into Bend because people don't leave that store very much, or they hadn't up until the COVID. It was fortunate they needed an action sports associate, and boom.
So you've been here 4 years now, is that correct?
Three and a half. Yeah.
So what's your verdict on living here in Bend? What's it been like for these 3.5 years?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's everything I thought it would be, and it just gets better and better. Really, I think in the beginning, you know, we had COVID kind of limited our social interactions and things like that. And so it was a little bit, it's kind of funny though. I guess when I really think about it, you know, working for REI, I already had a social group. And I also had a social group here in the past because just from my friend, she introduced me to a lot of people and I met friends through them. But I really just kind of had this built-in social base. So it was very easy and for me to just come and even during COVID to make friends and feel, you know, accepted and always had opportunities to do things. But it's just gotten better and better now. It's just, you know, I feel like I'm more settled. Mm-hmm. We've fixed up the house, and so we don't have a lot of that stuff that's kind of, you know, taking a lot of our time, but I feel like I'm fully immersed in it now.
So I know that you love the fact that, you know, skiing in winter, kayaking, hiking, backpacking, bike riding, whatever you want is all kind of available depending on the season. I know that Bend also, climate-wise, supposed to be somewhat similar to Southern California, right? A lot of sunny days.
Yeah.
But then also snowy winters.
Yeah.
Which is different, obviously,
definitely.
Than
yeah.
Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I think Bend has 300 sunny days every year.
Right, which is not what people think of when they think of Oregon weather.
Right. No, that's true. Because we are on
the east side
of the Cascades. And so we kind of, that's why I mentioned the desert. You know, we're right up against the desert, which is beautiful, which is why we have that sun. But I will tell you, this winter I feel like we've had a lot more cloudy mm-hmm. days than we have had sunny, for sure. It's okay. I still don't mind it, because the thing about winter, I think a lot of people, you know, complain, oh, this winter feels so long, and you know, it's snowing in town again, and you know, you have icy roads, and then you gotta shovel your driveway, and I, you know, for me, I just don't mind it. I don't mind it. To me, it's a different season. So that means it's different. And yeah, are there challenges? Sure. But you get up a little bit earlier because you know it's going to snow, or so you know you're going to have to shovel. And yeah, I don't know. I guess because it's part of the active lifestyle for me. And there are plenty of people who live in Bend that don't get outside, which I don't want to say shocks me, because, you know, it people come from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that if you don't get out in the winter, it's just cold.
Right? It's cold and inconvenient. Right.
Yeah. But my friends and I talk about like that hurdle. There might be a day where, oh, it's cold outside and you're just, you know, in the house and it's warm and it takes a little motivation. You got to get your gear together. once you get outside, you never regret it. And right. I always, you know, if I ever have a day like that, which is not very often anymore, I just know, no, you just get out there and, you know, you're skiing and it's, yeah, it might be cold, but if you're Nordic skiing, you're just going through the trees and you have these winter birds that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. Sometimes you'll see a little rabbit, you know, a little winter rabbit. Who gets to see the winter rabbit if you're not outside?
So you grow up in Los Angeles, which is among the bigger of cities in the world. Takes a very long time to get from one side of the city to the other.
Oh, gosh.
And now you live in Bend. Also, Los Angeles, notorious for horrible, horrible traffic. How does Bend as a city compare to your experiences in Los Angeles? And is there anything about Los Angeles that you miss being here in a smaller city?
I miss my people down in Los Angeles.
Yeah, but they could just move up here.
Yeah, and a lot of them are. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Bend is growing. Bend has over 100,000 people now. I would say we're probably close to 120,000. So traffic is becoming an issue. You know, the streets are basically, you know, one lane each direction, and we talked about roundabouts before, and now we have you know, our rush hours where, you know, you don't want to go on Reed Market, you know, anytime, you know, after, you know, between 2:30 and, you know, probably 4:30, because then you get caught in the school traffic. And then don't go on Reed Market or you know, put insert whatever street you're on, you know, at 5:30 or something. And, you know, there's all these times where you just try to avoid it if you're traveling by car. But Bend is such a easy city or town to get around on bicycle, even walking. I feel like it's, you know, there's definitely ways around it. My commute is very short. It's 2.5 miles from my house to REI. Most of the time I ride my bike. In wintertime, it gets a little bit dicey and I'll take the car. But yeah, I mean, people complain a lot and we do get a lot of traffic and I get it. And, you know, it's funny because people that have lived here a long time, oh gosh, another Californian has moved to Bend. God. And it's funny because, you know, when I first got here, you know, I'd meet somebody and, oh, so where are you from? Or where'd you come from? Or how long have you been in Bend? I'm like, I've been in Bend, you know, for just a few months. Where'd you come from? But funny thing is, most people I meet are from somewhere else. And I do have some friends that have been here for 30 years or more. They're still my friends, even though I moved here. And I have to tell you, I really have not had any shade thrown on me, you know, by anybody, at least to my face.
Just behind your back.
Just behind my back. Is probably what, and whatever, and that's fine. but I think Bend has the nicest people. I think Oregon in general has nice people, but I just think Bend has very, very nice people. And we're a purple city, a lot of blue, a lot of red politically, but I like the reds. I like the blues, and I feel like everyone seems to get along pretty well.
I mean, in theory, that should be the ideal, is you have both, and then you learn to live together, and then you learn to compromise, and you learn to agree and disagree and accomplish things together.
Yeah, totally.
So is there anything about LA that you miss?
You know, I think...
Other than the people.
Other than my people. You know, I think there are definitely little things, and there's more cultural opportunities down there and cultural arts and things like that. But Bend has more and more. You know, I think that that's going to continue to increase. I think I do miss the cultural diversity in terms of people, but, you know, I think Bend is becoming more culturally diverse as well. But I it still has a long way to go. There's really not much that I miss. Yeah, besides that.
So do you think this is where you want to stick around for the foreseeable future then?
Yeah, I'll definitely stick around here for a while.
And do you want other people to move here, or are you now in the boat of please stop moving to Bend, no more people coming to Bend, please?
You know, if people moved here and it made them happy, it makes the world a better place. Now, that said, you know, whenever a place gets too crowded, then yeah, it suddenly, you know, it's not... easy to move around anymore. Or, oh, that's the beach that I wanted to camp on. Now somebody else is there. Oh, I wanted to get a permit for that trail, but I can't because they're all, you know, the permits have been taken. And I think that is a problem. And I really, you know, that's, I struggle with that a lot. I mean, who am I to deny somebody the happiness that I've been able to, you know, achieve for myself or, you know, by moving here? And it is so beautiful, but, you know, but we also don't want it to become a major metropolitan area either. And I think, you know, that's the problem with growth. Do I hate people who move here? No. And there are some people that I know that want to move here, and I encourage them to. Because in the end, if you get a bunch of people who are moving here because they love the outdoors, they love the outdoor lifestyle, I think that it does make the place better. You just kind of, you know, it just brings you more challenges, you know, related to population.
All right. So we're rapidly approaching the end of this program. Are you ready?
I think so. I'm ready.
All right. Then I'm going to hit you with the final question of the show, which is there a final thought that you would like to leave the audience with?
Gosh, I guess, you know, really, I would say that, you know, life is short. If you really, really want to be somewhere other than where you are, go for it. Just, you know, you have nothing to lose. You can always go back. Although now everything's so expensive, maybe you can't go back. But, you know, the world is a big place. Getting smaller, but it's still a big place. I think it's just important to, you know, get out and pursue your dreams. And because, again, we're only here for a short time.
All right. I want to thank you for coming with me down to this riverside where we have just enough of an open area that we don't have to sit in the snow and we get to sit in the sun on this Bend winter. And thanks for coming and being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It has been a great pleasure.
Now it's that part of the show where I invite you all to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 123 with Marilee Vaulkes. And of course, you're going to find photographs of her in action and links to everything we talked about in today's show. And if you don't want to remember the URL to our website, or if you don't want to have to search through the site to find our links, you can always go into the show notes for this episode, wherever you are listening to it. Every link and more are included in those show notes. And if something you've heard today or in the past has inspired you to contact us here at the show, that can be done a number of simple ways. You can always send an email to jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send a text or leave a voicemail at 818-925-0106. And if you want to make me a very happy person, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed to the show. Please rate and review it. But most importantly, please share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. Next time on the show, come back August 1st for the last episode from Bend, Oregon. We will be speaking with Wasim Muklashi. He is an alpacapreneur, that is right, an alpaca entrepreneur, a photographer, a volunteer, a filmmaker. He has done a lot of work in the VR filmmaking field. And he is just an all-around awesome, wonderful person. So come back August 1st, Wasim Muklashi. See you then.